then the topic tonight is machlokes. And I'm starting with a ta'ora. I was once asked to speak. There is Kehila who had a very contentious rabbinic search. And they finally decided on the Rav. And they were looking to some way to heal the contentiousness of the community over the rabbinic search for the Rav for the shul. And they asked me to speak. So I said yes. I wasn't sure what I was going to say, but I said yes. And the point that I said was that we say every time, we say in davening three times a day, then the Shemoneh Esrei, then the Kaddish, or Yisrael Shalom B'Rimov, Yisrael Shalom Aleinu V'Kol Yisrael. So that's based on a pasuk in Iyov that the Rosh was Yisrael Shalom B'Rimov. Chazal say it's referring to the fact that there's a malach of Eish, there's a malach of Mayim, and Eish and Mayim normally don't get along with each other too well. Either the fire boils out the water, or the water puts out the fire. And the Baruch is able to find a way that these two karkas are able to be b'shalom. So I pointed out that the result isn't lukewarm water, right? A little fire, a little bit of water. That's not the point. Eish remains Eish, and Mayim remains Mayim. But they still find a way to interface. Shalom is not that everybody's mavater and then we end up not being what we are. That's not the point of shalom. Now, with a caveat, because yes, there's a certain point the person has to learn how to give a certain points away, not make them, make a stand on them. But the point of shalom is not that we dissolve an individual. And this I didn't say when I spoke. There's a fascinating study, which I do when I do my shalom bias about it. That I say over, there's a professor, a psychologist, from a guy named John Gutman. His name is A. John Gutman. A stands for Akiva, I think, something like that. His field is shalom bias. His field is studying marriages. And he's been doing this for 50 years, 40 years, 50 years. And one of his fascinating points he works on is trying to find what are the predictors which will predict a marriage which will last. And then how can you develop yourself into those type of people which can do those things. So he's been following marriages and these people he's been following, they answer surveys every year, etc., etc. And he found, which I will modify maybe for a frum family, a frum couple is a little bit different, then I'll tell you why. But he found that one of the best predictors of a marriage which will be stable, which will last, is the ratio of positive experiences to negative experiences, and the ratio is 5-1. Since the ratio of 5-1, those marriages last the longest. Ratios of 3-1 don't last as long. Ratios of 10-1 don't last as long. Well, that's fascinating, right? We would think, if 5-1 lasts, so 20-1 is even better, right? So his theory to explain what the problem is that the Russia made people different. And the nature is that we do rub against each other. If we don't express it and have those uncomfortable conversations, it's not because we've resolved it. It's because we're not willing to assert ourselves. But the problem with that is my emotional. Is that, imagine you take a finger and you make a very light touch over here. Maybe arouses one receptor of discomfort. Imagine you do that 1,000 times. What happens? It starts to hurt. Mm-hmm. And you do 10,000 times, and it's an open wound with pus coming out of it. So one of the spouses does something which irritates other spouse. If they're able to actually truly remove their mind from their mind, fine. I made a decision, it's not important, and I'm just saying it here, I'm saying it here, I truly don't care about it. It really doesn't bother me. Fine. If you really can say that and be honest, fine. The Rama says that there's, the Rebbe has a section in Chelek Beis on Vatronis, being Mevater. But he starts off with Kapdonis. He says, if something bothers you, you have to talk about it. The Rambam says, because the means that if something bothers you, you have to talk about it. So the Rambam understands it. So the Ramban understands it. Or I'm sorry, they're going to that pasuk. discuss it with somebody. I was going to say I'm right, you're wrong, but discuss it. Why you're doing what you're doing? It bothers me. It irritates me. Says, but the Russian says, if you want to be a vata, fine. If you truly are a vata, I have a problem with that. But if inside it bothers you, but you just don't say anything because it's uncomfortable or embarrassing to say something, or you don't feel you have a right to say something, whatever the reason might be, it's going to build up. And then when it builds up, eventually it explodes in a very negative way. So there's a horrible rabbi joke. Like one of the jokes, the only rabbis would make jokes like this. It says, this couple comes to rabbi, they want to get divorced. So the rabbi says, you know, we always try and see if we can reconcile before we divorce. The man says, I'm sorry, rabbi, there's nothing to talk about. He says, you know, just tell me what it is. Let me hear it. Rabbi says, there's nothing to talk about. Tell me what it is. He says, okay, I'll tell you what it is. He says, the problem is that I'm a roller and my wife is a squeezer. He says, what does that mean? He says, Rabbi, there are two ways to deal with toothpaste tubes. You can roll the toothpaste tube, or you can squeeze it. When you roll it, it's nice and clean. When you squeeze it, it's a mess. I can't take it anymore. I'm done. Right? That's the joke. Right? That's ridiculous, right? You don't get divorced because of a toothpaste tube. Now, the reason why it's a joke is because after sitting in many different tone bias situations and hearing people's complaints, they sound like toothpaste tubes. So what's the pshat? The people are idiots. Right? They're not idiots. You know, like you're really getting so angry over a toothpaste tube or whatever it is. So Dale Carnegie has a story in one of his books. I don't remember which one. About a group of scientists which went to Antarctica for research. Now, you can't. There's no place to fly a plane down there. There's no airstrip to land. So they go by boat. So the problem is there's ice. So you can't take a boat to the... So the summer there, the port is ice-free for about 2 months of the year. So 2 months a year, people can come in and out by boat. But once you're there, you're there. You're there for 10 months. Now, you can't live above ground because the temperatures are like, you know, they would endanger life. So everything is underground. They have caverns underground, which they built, which they have living space and working space, etc. So they go out for expeditions above ground once in a while. So you're basically spending 10 months in these underground, in these caverns, like, you know, the five or six areas that they have, with the same people for 10 months. So, and they're scientists, you know, so they have their different attitudes and idiosyncrasies and, you know, and shiktas and all the different stuff. So this is a true story. He says, scientist X sits down by breakfast the first day across from scientist Y. Scientist Y is, his field is nutrition. And he's done a lot of very major studies on nutrition, and he feels that saliva is extremely important for the enzymes in the saliva are very important for the process of digestion. And therefore, he chews every morsel that he eats 42 times. That's the idea. So scientist X is across from scientist Y, and puts a morsel in his mouth and chews it 42 times. The next morsel, 42 times. This guy is like, it's a little bit like uncomfortable. But he doesn't say anything. Why? Because, like, what's wrong with you? Like, what do you care what I do with how I chew my food? So it's embarrassing to admit that it bothers you.
Eventually, he screams.
So lunchtime is the same thing. Supper time is the same thing. But he's not going to say anything. He's not going to move. Like, why are you moving? He's not going to say anything because, like, what's your problem? Like, you know, the person who's writing the story, the scientist X, writes that the end of the 10 months, it took every ounce of my self-control not to commit murder. This is what he writes. Mm-hmm. That he was so enraged by it. It's that little thing, which is, it's a nothing. But it's thousands and thousands of times. It drives you crazy. So the Rambam says that there's a mitzvah to express it and discuss it. If you could truly move on, that's fine. But if you can't, but you were embarrassed. Like, you know, the husband's supposed to say to the wife that, you know, that she chews loudly, it bothers him. Like, he's going to say that to his wife. Really? You know, like, you know, that's his wife. But it bothers him. And, you know, and then they have guests, but it bothers him even more. He's embarrassed. So, you know, like, so what's he supposed to do? It's going to set, it's going to create some type of distance in his relationship because he's not addressing it. Mm-hmm. So the Rambam says, you don't have the option. Now, you don't, a person has to say it in an intelligent way. Or a person can make a choice to say, like, why would they find my wife? And what people think about her? Like, she's one of the women. She happens to be, she breathes loud when she chews. Okay, so what? And I'm a tzaddik. I'm not perfect either. You know, like, well, like, you know, so, like, you know, I snore horribly. Like, you know, I don't know. Like, you know, like, it doesn't have to bother you. You can make it as, person can truly create a thought process where it doesn't bother them. If they can do that, great. But if they can't, to leave it there, so that's what he's writing. When the negative emotions are not, things are not happening, usually it's not because everything's wonderful, it's because the people are not comfortable talking about it. Eventually, there was a book which came out, I don't know how many years ago, called The 1 Minute Manager. That was the name of the book. It's written towards business management. And one of his points was that a lot of managers don't like confrontation with their employees. Mm-hmm. So when they point out something which they're not happy with, they sort of like ignore it. Until they explode. Mm-hmm. If they would have addressed it up front, it would have been uncomfortable a little bit, it would have been taken care of, and never would have exploded. So they destroy the relationship. She says that 1 minute conversation that you could have had up front, you know, it's probably not good to do this. And that's all. It could have done very minimal type of emotion. Is much better than the other option. But people tend towards the other option because it's uncomfortable to have the confrontations. So the point of getting back to my point, the version didn't say that the A should end up not being A, and Mayim should not end up being Mayim. The version said A and Mayim are going to figure out a way to coexist. With A still being Aish and Mayim still being Mayim. That's the Arshah Shalom Bimraimov that the Rosh was talking about. So I said to the Kehila, I said, you know, you've shown strong emotion. That means that there's something you believe in very much. That's good. I'm happy you did that. But the fact that you both show strong emotion in different directions doesn't mean you can't find a way to coexist. Like, the thought process, well, if I'm, we can't work. Right, so we have to learn how to be mevater. Like, that's always the message. Yes, that is a wonderful thing. But there is a message to learn. You know, I can learn to respect you for the fact that you have your position, even though I disagree with your position tremendously. That doesn't mean I can't respect you, and I cannot interface with you respectfully. In our society, you know, civility in disagreements has went out the window. But. In the Torah's attitude, the more it talks about a machlokes hishna shemayim misayfel liskayim, I have a better idea. She was severely bato, right? We should, you know, b'tzadikim b'shem shemayim, they should work it out. Didn't say that you're supposed to work it out, right? B'sham b'shilu, all the examples. B'sham b'shilu, let's look at machlokes b'shem shemayim. B'sham b'shilu didn't work out all their problems. They still argued. But they respect each other. They love each other. They married between each other, etc. And when they're back on this and they're back on that, the more says the Rishami pointed out to Basilo that this is somebody you're not allowed to marry. Right? They tremendously respect each other, and they fought like cats and dogs. It makes matters. It wasn't that they were mavater. Beishami remained Beishami with all of its vehemence, and I'm sure that the conversations were very strong. And Basilo was Basilo, and one of them to the other. Right. So, the context of something which was important this is Torah, this is Emes. I don't write just be mavater because, you know, I'd rather feel comfortable for having shalom. So the finding the balance is very hard. There is a mosir machlokas hashemayim. You don't write to be mavater machlokas hashemayim. But so much is not, you know, but it's not l'shem shemayim. You should, you know, many times you should search deep inside yourself if you can find a way to move on. You shouldn't hold on to it. But if you can't, you got to address it. That's not always the thought process of people. Like, sometimes a person needs a new perspective. You know what? A person says, let me go to the third party and truly listen to them. You know, this is bothering me. Because a lot of times we start getting upset about something, we start reading into it a whole slew of thought processes. The person is being insensitive to my feelings, the person is doing a pedafka, the person is doesn't really understand me. Like, it's not, the problem is not just the action, it's this whole conversation which comes with it. Right? So the wife is, you know, the husband snores. So I says, you know, I can't sleep. I'm so late. He doesn't care about it. And maybe he doesn't realize he's snoring. No, he knows he's snoring. He just doesn't care about me. You know, like, why are you saying that? You know, the person gets frustrated or something. They don't think of doing it intelligently, right? You know, she eats loudly. Like, you know, like, it's so embarrassing for me. Like, she doesn't care about my, you know, I had my boss over and she did it for my boss. Like, you know, like, and what does she think about me? You know, like, hello? She doesn't realize she's doing it. Like, you know, but, you know, or the person, so a lot of times the person needs to know, goes to the right, says, like, you know, I understand the other side. I understand that sometimes that there's no other side, that it's not really an issue. You know, there's many different ways of dealing with it. Putting it in perspective of significance. different techniques that you try and use. So, specifically the same in a marriage. The Rambam says a person is a chid b'mechabit ishta yosem migufoy. So Rambam, it's halacha, it's the same halacha as, you know, right here. So a person comes to Shemayim 120 years and says, you know, will you mechabit your wife? He says, yeah. Well, what about this time? You know, Bresham, it wasn't my fault. You know, she burnt the cholos. And all the malachim and shemayim just are laughing at you. Like, you know, you were over a halacha because of burnt cholos. What, are you an idiot? Right? So you picture the malachim laughing at you. You're probably not motivated to be upset about it. It gives perspective. Like, you know, you're going to come to Shemayim, you're going to sit in Bezal Shemaba, they're going to be tabeah you, like, you didn't do your responsibilities, that Torah is mechayev you vis-a-vis this woman who took care of you in many different ways and raised your children, etc. It's a tremendous tabeah. And, you know, and you're going to say, it wasn't my fault. I had to do it because she chewed loudly. Like, if anybody would have the idiocy to say that in Bezal Shemala, I mean, that'd be one thing. But if they did, like, the malachim would laugh at him to the Gehenna of the embarrassment would be right there. Like, really? That's why this one tremendous, beautiful Bas Yisrael, wonderful neshama, that you have responsibility for more than any other person in the world, and you hurt her because she chews loudly? What is wrong with you? So you put it in perspective. That's probably not worth getting upset about. Right, Fran has a story that he says. It's not a comfortable story. It's not a comfortable story. I'm telling you a problem. So, couple, the husband was a type A personality, very aggressive, intensive, assertive, go-getter, etc. The wife was mamash the opposite. Israeli woman, laid back, you know. Like, you know, yeah, we're going out. Eventually it's going to be okay. Well, and then every time he would get all upset about something, you know, she said, you know, I don't see why it's so important. Like, why are you getting so upset about this? Because that didn't work out. Okay, so we didn't, you know, we came up late. Okay, so why are you getting upset? And it just to drive him, got him very upset that she would react like that. Okay. Summertime, the wife and the family would go up to the bungalow in the mountains. The husband would stay in the city to work, and he would come up for Shabbos. So he comes up for Shabbos 1 week, and he sees that his wife has left her purse hanging on the baby's crib. The purse has muxin, and it has her checkbook, and it has her wallet. And he felt it was inappropriate that she should leave her purse hanging on the baby's crib. You know, now, halachically, it's probably not a boss's. Yeah, but she was a shochach, etc. But you be more careful about that. She said, "You're right, I should be more careful." But I don't know why getting upset about it. I forgot. Why get so upset? Zilo chashuv, she said. It's not important enough to get upset about it. Fine. To Sunday night, he drives back to the city. And Monday, he's sometime in the middle of the week, he gets a phone call that wife was pregnant. And there's been complications in the pregnancy, and she's been taken to the hospital. Come immediately. By the time he gets back to the, he gets to the car, he drives as quickly as he can back to the mountains. By the time he gets to the wife has passed away. So he's in the hospital, and he deals with all the different arrangements, etc. Then he goes back to the bungalow. He walks in, and the purse is still hanging on the crib. He takes out the checkbook, and he writes the check to pay for the funeral. He says, you know what? She was right. It really wasn't important. From the perspective of that, why to do that? That's the story. It's not a comfortable story, but it's perspective. Sometimes we don't have perspective. We blow things out of proportion, and we step out of it. A week from now, is it going to bother you that this person did this to you? No, probably not. So why get upset about it now? If a week from now it's not going to bother you, why now? Tara says, with a little bit of distance, you look back and say, it wasn't so important. So use that distance now. Well, now you don't have distance, but you know that you'll have distance, and that's where you're going to react. So trust your intellect that this is not something worth getting upset about. You move on with life, you realize it wasn't so important, it wasn't so significant, the person didn't meet it, and maybe there's another perspective, and everything rolled into one. You move on with life. So fine. So it'll take you a year. Okay, but maybe. I don't know. Whatever the number is. So there are different ways of... And part of the reason why we get upset is because we're sensitive. I mean, we don't like being ignored. We don't like being spoken down to. We have different, and we create narratives that this person is ignoring me, and this person is hurting me, this person doesn't respect me, this person doesn't understand me. I mean, all those wonderful words, if you really understand, what we're really saying is, I want to be recognized as a significant person, and please don't step on me. So you know what? You are a significant person. Baruch Hashem, Hashem made you, but he doesn't make mistakes. Gewaldig. But why is your definition of being significant not being told him what he thinks? So he doesn't think highly of you, so now what? Okay, move on with life. There's many different ways we can do it to put it in perspective that's not important. And if it's truly not important, you're going to move on. But if you can't move on, keeping this out of you is worse. Obviously exploding and saying it is not going to solve the problem either. But, a person finds the opportunity, and says, by the way, the conversation we had, I felt that you really did not understand. You didn't really listen to my position, and I found that uncomfortable and painful. And I really would appreciate the next time we have a conversation to really try to understand what I'm saying, as opposed to just not listening. Okay, so you can say that, like that tone of voice, 3 weeks later, in perspective, and the person might say, you're really stuck on that. So, I moved on with life. He says, I appreciate the email, but it's important for the future because it might happen again. I just want to point that out. Okay. And that's better than not. So, there is a musig machlokes, which is a valid point, But you have to decide. Not everything is a valid point. If every point is a valid point, it means none of the points are valid. Because some things are important, some things are less important, and you have to measure it against the value of. The relationship, or the value of the shalom bayis, the value of the needs for the children for stability, whatever those are, you have to measure it. But once you measure it and you decide it's not important, you can't hold on to it and say it is important, really. That's not fair. That's the point the Rambam is saying. That's a... Then the second half of the conversation. So you have Machlokes Shem Shemai. The person says, you know what's on the Bavim? It's about Kadosh Baruch. So Rashiva told us a story. So Rashiva said it over. So he would used to say Parshas Pinchas. So Rekipta was a strong, the Telzer position was strong anti-Zionist. Okay, if you spoke about that.
Interesting.
You know, Telzer didn't get, the Telzer Rav was a very controlled person. He didn't say it in a passionate way, but he felt it was misleading, it was dangerous, etc. There was a Zionist convention in Telz in 1936. You know, the city was a different spectrum of different people. They brought in, they made a convention. So Rav Gifter, together with three other Bachrim, decided that they're going to disrupt the convention. So what are they going to do? It was being held in the theater, which is all, it's a wooden building. And the fear of fire was tremendous. So the four Bachrim, the gift of three Bachrim, went to they had this major speaker they brought in for the keynote speech, and they put themselves in the four corners of the building. And when the speaker would reach the climax of his drasha, they would scream out fire and stampede the whole building out. That's what they did. The drasha was all scream fire, and everybody stampeded out. He gets a message the next day that the Rashiva wants to speak to him. So Gifter said, "This is Hichigamet, I'm getting a Yeshakoyach. I was going into the room with the intent that I'm going to get thanked." So he tells the Rav, says, "Didn't get upset at me, didn't scream at me." He says, he said it in Yiddish, he says but Proos Sinit Kanos, Wildkeit is nothing but Kanos, Hashem Shemaim. I raised for Yeshiva for a week, I threw on Yeshiva for a week. So where he can go home. He went to the city base matters, and he learned for a week over there. And some woman had rachmanas, and she brought him some food, and that's how he survived for a week. You know.
But what did he say? What was the translation?
He said, "This is being wild. There's nothing to do with kanos. You think that you're a kanoi, like Hashem Shemai. I mean, you're being mechanic. Ashkenaz the Shabbos because you and Pinchas, Imamish, you and Pinchas are saving Klal Yisrael. You know." He says, Pinchas was a kanoi, and you're wild. Wild is nothing with kanois. Right. So the Rashiva then would say over, says, "So how do you know which one it is?" Mm-hmm. Which one is it? So he said, now, I'm gonna add a connection to it afterwards, but what he said was, he said, most of us do not get extremely passionate over putting on tefillin. Maybe we should, but we don't. You know, we put the mitzvah, we do it, you know, but it's like, I'm so overwhelmed, emotionally excited. Tefillin. No, we don't. We should, maybe, but we don't, right? He says, if you're doing the kanos with the same level of passion as you're putting on tefillin, it's a mitzvah. Mm-hmm. If you feel passionate about it, it's being wild. He said, why? Because we're not holding madrigas and feeling passionate about Kodesh Baruch Hu's mitzvahs. So why are we feeling passionate about it? Because we feel it's personally negated to us. That's not kanos anymore. He says, if I can deal with this act of standing up strongly, etc., with total equanimity, and not get emotional about it, then it's a Hashem Shemai. And if not, it's about me. That's what Rashiva said. So, which passes about 99% of the times when we do things to Shem Shemayim.
Right, it's usually that's what pushes you to do something.
It's like,
that's not to the passion.
the Kotzker Rebbe one time said, it says, Anshei Stoyim Roy Mechatoyim Lashem Oid. Says, Anshei Stoyim Roy Mechatoyim, because everything was Hashem Shemayim. I'll still go to Hashem Shemayim. Lashem Oid. They were still Hashem Shemayim. And they were talking such Roy Mechatoyim. You know? It's a good line. It's a Me'ashe Medrash. The Medrash actually says Kamat that Musa. They made a sheet out of it. And this is an important sheet, and this is what's going to maintain the continuity of the world. And they got so passionate about it, and the male, you can't back down because it's a sheet now. I tell people, get up, somebody, just don't make sheetas, please. Just stay away from sheetas. Because then you can't back down. Because then I'm destroying my whole shita. You know what? I personally, it bothered me. So you know what? I decided it doesn't bother me anymore. I decided I want to move on with life, etc. But if this is such an important yesod about relationships, so I'm supposed to change my right? So that's the problem you have, with all these conversations you have between two ideologies. That people can't back down, so they can't have conversations. Okay, that's a little bit of hakdama to the shir. Did you ever listen to the tapes from Rabbi Vader Miller? He'll talk for 40 minutes and say, okay, now we've had to... No, for the shir. That was introduction. Really? Okay. Now, I have to apologize that we're having some problems with the printing. And so it's cutting off on the bottom. And if I'm on my A game, there's a way to fix it manually every time you print. But if I forget, because I'm busy with something else, I send the print, because it used to work like that. And I was like, oh, did it again. The second set of pages is a piece, there's a sefer, which it says, the name of the sefer is Me'eva La'ahava, from hatred to love. And it's put out actually by a person in Tzfas named Rabbi Baruch Heifetz. His family in Cleveland, Johnny Heifetz, his brother, Jonathan Heifetz. So the Sefer is about Yisro L'Sisna Z'chicha B'Vavachot. So he talks about when is Sina Skin and when is Sina valid. You have a right, you have this, sometimes the Shem Shemaim, you have to do it. So how can you tell? The same thing when it comes to Machloikis. So he says the first way you can test yourself, what is the issue? He says, Machloikis negative deus or negative bali deus? Are you arguing about the ideologies or about the people? You're going against them? Well, if they believe in that, they have to be bad people, therefore I have to go against them. No. They're not bad people. They believe in something very passionately. They believe it. So I'm going against their shita, and I'm going against their day, and I need to address it. I feel it's wrong, and I need to make a stand. Okay. What do the person? There's a maisa with Rav Chaim Sonnenfeld and Rav Kook. So they came to... there was a bris in Yerushalayim. They both came to the bris, and they sat and they were waiting for the Bali bris. So they were talking and learning. After a while, the Bali simple weren't coming, so Rav Kook says to Rav Yosef Chaim, he says, the more as Machlok is on them b'shtei shows, but the 3 hours already, the 3 hours, I have a case exactly with how 3 hours went by, but, nobody's toyah b'shtei. So the Velt says over the story, Yosef Chaim said back to him, and what's the person who's tired his whole life? that's the zog that everybody says over. Nobody says over the fact that Rabbi Yosef Chaim and Rabbi Kook sat and talked and learning for 3 hours. He had tremendous respect for Rabbi Kook. He felt he was wrong. And to the point he called him a toyah. But he was very comfortable talking to him learning for 3 hours. Fast forward three generations, the people are following Rabbi Yosef Chaim are not having conversations from the people following Rabbi Kook for 3 hours. I'm against you. I don't believe in your shita, and you're bad, and you're wrong. It's a whole it's a connect in the Bali Adai. One of the issues, one that if you're old enough to remember, or you're familiar enough to remember that the Satmar Rebbe was very strongly against the Babaji Rebbe, extremely strong, positions against the Lubavitcher Rebbe in certain things. The Lubavitcher was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and the Sofer was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And they have a right to disagree, and they have a right to disagree strongly. The problem is that the Hasidim got involved, and they used to have fights. There was fights between Sofer Hasidim, Lubavitcher Hasidim, the Sofer Hasidim going to from Williamsburg to Crown Heights and picking a fight, and vice versa. You know, so they said, what's the pshat? If it means L'shem Shemayim, you can't get in a fist fight L'shem Shemayim. You know, you can't hit somebody L'shem Shemayim. And he says, the answer by Father Kapp, this is, you know, when they say the Yiddish word, you know, from my Rebbe, is mine and Rebbe. The main word over there is mine, not Rebbe. When it's mine, so you're hurting mine, it's about me. So I'm going to hit you. It's about the Rebbe, so it's the Rebbe, okay, then I'm going to have to hit you. If it's mine, I got to hit you. So you get the day or against the belly of the day? Okay. The second mivchan is the Tvelos Amitis, or Hitznatzkus. So he writes over here, Rabbi Heifetz, he writes, imagine they're having a fight, and the other side all of a sudden says, you know what, I realize that I'm wrong, and I'm doing tshuva, and I'll never have the position again. So what's your reaction? Chas Hashem, Baruch Hashem. Now we don't have to fight anymore. Or, I was having so much to show you why I'm right. You know, I'm going to win. Is the goal winning? Is the goal the Shev Shemayim? You don't have to win. You have to present the right? If the person now sees your position, you know, Baruch Hashem, you don't have to fight anymore. If you're there for the fight, right? Like some people, like they enjoy the fight, you know, or and even if they don't enjoy the fight, but they once they're in the fight, they're going to win. There was a Maisa Shahaya this week, or last week. No, I'm sorry, I heard about it last week. I don't know when it took place, but it took place recently. There's a man who's he's a Ma'agen and his wife. So in Eretz Israel, a person could be jailed for that.
What's the Ma'agen?
Refused to give his wife a get.
Guna.
He's been Ma'agen her. Literally, the word Eugen is an anchor. He's holding her down. She can't move. That's what Eugen is. The Mori in Bobasa uses that word for an anchor. So it's been 20 years. He's in jail. He's been in jail for many, many years. Some Askalim came up with the following idea. They're going to give him a sales pitch, which he can't refuse. They're going to arrange that he can move to Kila, you know, Community X, with nobody knowing his background, you know, give him X amount of money to live on, you know, basically find him a job, recreate a life for him, and give him, snip him out the money as well, to divorce his wife. All he has to do is to sign on the paper. If not, to take him back to the jail cell. So they pulled him out. They told him the deal. They took him to the airport with the bracelet, with the two guards and the bracelet on his foot. And they arranged it with the government already. So, you know, you sign here, they take up the bracelet, here's the tickets are right here. You will get on this plane, fly to City X, there's a house there, there's a job there, everything's set up for you. And here's $100,000. He says, I can't sign because so-and-so, she's right. She wins and I can't do it. I'm going back to the jail cell. Because he won't let her win. So he has to win. So sitting in jail cell is called winning. Right? But that's how people stay. That's what people think. You know. So if it's about winning, right? The Chofetz Chaim talks about it in the Lashon Hara cases. You know, you can't let someone else have the last word. If it's about trying to work out the issue, and you know, correcting it or at least making a stance of Shem Shemayim, I make my stance of Shem Shemayim. End the conversation. I don't have to win. Yeah. Then he says, you like fighting? It's good. There are cases where we're able to fight without any problems. Base managers, you're allowed to fight with each other. If you need that, we'll find. We'll give you a chetimsis. As long as the conversation, even in base managers, is about. I've watched conversations, people arguing pshat l'gemara, getting personal. Right? That the person took a position, now that's him. And if he is mevatar in his position, means something wrong with him. So he's going to keep fighting, even though he's wrong in the gemara, because he can't accept that being wrong in the gemara means he's something wrong with him. Now that's not true, but that's how people's mind thinks. Like, you're a wonderful person. You got wrong shot the Gemara. Like, one or the other. Like, let's go back a step. Did you really think you're infallible? No. You can make mistakes. Yeah, but I should be right. I should be wrong, and he should be right. And I can't deal with it. There's a maestro with the Brisker Rav. In Europe, many of the larger cities, the Rav's role was not dealing with day to day issues. They were taking care about the diet. The Rav would say drush tashir. He would like. Policy issues, he would, be involved in, etc. But, the daily Piskei Lach was done by the Bezdin or one of the Dalem, etc. So Brisk, the person that dealt with the most issues was a person named Simcha Zeller. Simcha Zeller Rieger, he was the Dayan of Brisk. The Brisker Rav, the Chaim Brisker trusted him tremendously. So one day, Rav Simcha Zeller comes to Rav Chaim, he says, I need to understand something. He says, he had a Maisa Shehoya. A few weeks ago, the butcher came to him with a halacha shayla on a behemah. Now in Europe, these people were not rich. The butcher was not rich. They would lay out money, buy a behemah, have a shechted, and if the animal was kosher, they were able to sell this kosher meat. They got their money back. If not, they could go bankrupt. They didn't have large sums of money. If they don't have the money, they can't sell it for kosher meat. You sell it to the goyim for bobkas, and a loss like that once, twice, you're out of business. You're done. So there was a half maruba. He comes to Rav Zeller. Rav Gifta told us a story that he remembered. His shmir was the same relation in Tells. So Rav Yitzchak Bloch was the Rosh Hashiva and the Rav, and his shmir was Rav Zalman Bloch. Rav Zalman was the Dayan. It's like most of the shalos went to Rav Zalman. So he remembers his shmir one time being up the whole night working on a heter for a tray for a shalom trefas on a behemoth. Because otherwise, you wiped out the butcher. He's done. It's half some rupa to the nth degree. So he spent the whole night working out a hefter. Shiva told me in the context is that nowadays, we that the attitude towards kashrus, pas, treifas, those things, it's a little bit too flippant. He says, the covered rosh that his shmir sat in the hand of the shadow, what is it? Doesn't exist anymore. That was Shiva's point. So this butcher comes to Simcha Zelig, and Simcha Zelig, looks it over. There's no shayla. The behemoth is a trefa. So he tells the butcher that the behemoth is a trefa. The butcher says, like a tear comes down of his eyes. He says, that's what Rashi wants. Makab. Good. A few weeks later, there's a din Torah between the butcher and a customer. The customer was elegant. The whole issue was a few pennies. And the person was elegant, passed him for the customer's favor. And the butcher cursed him out. He yelled at him and called him names, you're talking about, etc. So he says to Rav Chaim, I don't understand. 3 years ago, I passed him the Shaila, which the value of the Shaila was 1,000 times more valuable than the dintar between him and the customer. And that is Makabal with the Shem Shemaim. The person wills it, that's the way it has to be, and the conversation. And over here, it's 1,000th of the cost. He's getting so upset at the point that he's being revised, publicly saying things about me, which most people realize is probably not true. So he's embarrassing himself to the nth degree and publicly, and he doesn't even realize. What's the pshat? So Chaim said to him, he said, in the first scenario, there was no other party.
just not winning.
Here, it's not. He can't deal with the fact that the other person won. So Rav Chaim told. So it's this issue of winning. There's also so Rav Chaim said continually said. Says, you ever watch when a horse goes down to the lake to drink? What's it do? He said, yeah, it stomps its feet in the water. He says, what's it doing? He says, it comes down to the water and looks in the water, and there's a horse there trying to drink the water. So it stomps with its feet to make the horse go away. You know what happens when the horse stomps back? So it stomps even more. That was Rav Chaim's uptight, what we look like. Somebody taking money from you, like the whole thing is ridiculous. The Bershom fears the belt, you know. It was supposed to be, not supposed to be, like, you know, the Bezim Paskin and the conversation. But that was Chaim's muscle of the uptight of what we look like. We look at the fared by the teich, by the river, you know, trying to drink. It's a fascinating thing that maybe, you know, when I was younger, I wasn't like this. But when I got older, like, you know, I started seeing things from different angles a little bit. Like, you know, I'll have a conversation with somebody, you know, someone raised me and said, you know, that's a good point. Thank you for pointing it out. The person was expecting, like, you know, I'm going to disagree because I, you know, have a position like this. I said, no, you're right. I should have thought of that. I should have been aware of that. So one person accused me of saying, I'm doing that just not to have, just to be able to get the guy off my back. He said, no, I can't make you believe me. I hear your point. It's a good point. What am I supposed to do? You got a good point. I was wrong. I apologize. So I said to me, you're still not fun. You can't get a good fight with you. I said, listen, I can fight. I'm not a fight, you know. If I believe the fight about, I'll fight. But if the person got a good point, they got a good point. And 99% of the cases, usually both parties have a good point. So as much as you got a good point, I can't ignore it. Now I have a good point also. You know, but that's not the conversation right now. I'm not trying to explain to him why I have a good point. He's trying to tell me why he has a good point, and he does. Now, do I want to move the conversation to the other? Maybe, yeah, maybe no. But like, that wasn't the conversation. He didn't come to me to say why I have a good point. Usually, that's not what happens. Usually comes to me explaining why he has a good point. So he does. So I say, you have a good point. Now what? Now, my wife is right. It's a very good tactic. Like, you know, you have two people arguing. The person says, you know, I'm right. The person says, yeah, you're right. He says, I'm really right. He says, yeah, you're really right. I'm really, really right. You know, after the third time, you're like, what's the argument? You can't keep yelling. Like, you know, you're right. You know, it's a very good way to diffuse an argument. Right? You know, why do more people use it? I don't know. I mean, it seems like such a logical way of dealing with it. You know, that's why my wife said that I'm not fun to fight with, because, like, you know, yeah, like, you know, but I wasn't like that when I was younger. But as you get older, like, you realize, like, you know, everybody's got a good point. Everybody has perspectives, and from their vantage point, they're right, or they have a very good point at least, or they have a good point. You know that. I'll just tell you the whole like this. I had a crazy maisa when we got married. The first year we were married, my wife got sick, and we didn't have any doctor yet. You know what? So I went to somebody recommendation of the name of a doctor. He gave the name of a doctor who lived, you know, near where we lived in Cleveland, in the Carmel. And my wife went to the doctor and came back and said the doctor yelled at her. No, I never heard a doctor yelling at a patient before in my life. Like, you know, like, what's the guy's problem? Like, this is ridiculous. You're not going at that doctor. Just on the game. Okay, fast forward about 3-4 years later, and my wife and I have a conversation, and I said something in my mind in an assertive tone of voice, but in no way, you know, I'm raising my voice. That my wife says, don't yell at me. I said, I'm not yelling at you. She says, yes, you are. All of a sudden, this light bulb goes off in my head. I said, you know, like 5 years ago when you went to that doctor, what did he tell you? I never asked her. What, you know. He says, you don't take care of your health. You really take care of your health, you know. Like, your mom, she yelled at me. I realized that the woman's evidence of being yelled at is different than a man's. But what's very important to recognize in the world of communication by definition is not what you said, it's what the other person heard. You didn't communicate what you said. You communicated what the other person heard. So if you don't know what the other person heard, you haven't done what you communicated. So I didn't yell. That's ridiculous. Because the definition of yelling is what you communicated. If you communicated yelling, you yelled. You hold it's not called yelling. Okay, so you have a shita. It's a shita. I hold a shita, it's not called yelling. So let's have an argument. But that's ridiculous. I mean, I don't care what your shita is. You know, but you're dealing with somebody, you need to... If you don't like being yelled at, don't yell at your wife. But she has a right to have her definition. She's on the receiving end. She finds that type of a statement uncomfortable. She has a right to say so. No, you should not feel uncomfortable because it's not really yelling. You know, like, really? You know, you say that tone of voice, like, you know, I'm not yelling at you right now either. I guess, well, I should, yes, you are. Like, you know, these are the conversations I get from people. I don't know, like, you know, are you using your head? Like, what are you missing in this conversation? Like, she doesn't, like, I just saw an article now this last week about, you know, do the Jews have the right to define what anti-Semitism is? Because according to some of the you know, the versions now, like, you know, I don't know why you're going to be insulted with anti-Semitism. We didn't mean it. Like, it's anti-Semitism. It's not anti-Semitism. You know, the blacks have a right to define what anti-black is. They get a lot to be upset about something. How dare you say that to me? I didn't mean anything. But I felt upset about it. You're like, you shouldn't do that to me. That's okay. They have a right to define that. And, you know, the this one and that one. But the Jews not. That's the article's point. Okay. And the wife not also. She has the right to define what it means that you're being ignored. Come on, ignore my wife. She says, I'm being ignored. She has the right to find what you feel. She has the right to. She's feeling ignored. You should not feel ignored because I'm not really ignoring you. But I'm not communicating well, I'm not ignoring you. Like, but I'm telling you, I get conversations like this. I look at people like, you know, like how can you argue about what the definition of ignored is? A definition of ignored, the person who's being ignored has a right to define that. Now, you might decide that the person's definition of it is beyond what you're able to give. Okay, so you have to say, you know, I really feel bad that that's how you're perceiving it, and I'm not good at giving it as much as you need. I'm going to work on it, and you'll chew me in better sometimes. Okay, that's great. That's a normal conversation. I'm admitting that, you know, the person has a criteria which I didn't necessarily intuit myself. I need to learn more about it. I'm willing to learn more about it because I care about you enough that I don't want you to feel like that. And yes, I'm admitting up front that I'm not going to be good at it. I'm going to work on it. I need help. Like, you can't ask the person more than that. No, you should be able to figure out yourself. So, you know, you're right, I should, but I don't, and I'm willing to work on being better at it. I would like you to help me along the way. I don't want to help you to figure out yourself. Like, you know, okay, so I feel bad that you feel bad about it. To the point that you know, that right now you feel it, and hopefully you'll and I will work on it. But I will work. You know, like, okay, like. I, you know, yes, I wish when the boss said, you know, go to the fourth floor, that I could jump straight to the fourth floor, but I can't. It takes me time. I want to go to the fourth floor. I really do want to get there. It's going to take me some time. And I'm willing to work step by step to get there. And I apologize that it's painful, and I will try and be better at it. And, I can't give more than I can give. But to say that that you don't have a right to define what your needs are, well, you have too many needs. Okay, so you know what? We'll figure that out. So the Russian put you here. You do the best as you can. You know. I don't know. I find people fascinating.